Welcome to episode 4 of Terrifying Tales, the podcast. We are your hosts, Tyler, Sean,
hey,
and Dwayne.
Hello.
And today, we're talking about Mage of the Ascension. How the hell is that a horror game? True evil in your TTRPGs and how that interacts with consent. So buckle up, it's about to get creepy.
Never going to get better.
Only worse. So, yeah. Mage the Ascension. And the World of Darkness. So before I start talking nonstop, since I know it's mostly me this time, I'm going to ask Dwayne.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Tell us about your experiences with the World of Darkness. Mage in particular, but World of Darkness in general, which mostly comes from me, so bear that in mind, audience. It's all tainted by me.
Well, as you could imagine, just in saying the name World of Darkness, it's designed to be a horror game. I mean, I've loved every one that I've played in. I don't even know how many. It's been enough that Tyler has run on different occasions, but I mean, all of them have that creepy, even if it's at the lowest available or lowest possible point, it still has that air of creepiness, that feeling of unknowing, you know, that every turn or any deal or word that you say could inevitably kill you.
You can never drop the creepy setting down to less than one.
It's it's
but one still is like 11, basically, exactly. on the relative scale. Yeah.
One is like a thermostat that never actually goes under 60, even though you set it for 20.
Yeah.
Right. You're like, oh man, it's still warm in here.
Don't understand. So I was going to ask Dwayne about his favorite character, but instead, because I know Voodoo Arcade's going to listen to this podcast, I want you to talk about Spider Lady.
What was her name?
Oh, wow. Wait, I don't even remember.
I don't remember what her name was.
Yet.
No, Dwayne was a were-spider in an offline game. I was a were-spider.
Oh, yeah. It was awesome. Yes, I was a were-spider.
That sounds terrible.
I was the obligatory Black Widow. I went around. I was very beautiful. I just picked up men and ate them.
Wait, you were a were-spider in a mage game?
Werewolf. Well, it was it was a crossover, but most of them, I think we had 2 mages and 4 shifters, if I remember right. No, 2 mages. 3 shifters and a changeling.
Hashtag cross splat.
Yes.
Correct. The best part for Voodoo Arcade is that those who know anything about World of Darkness know that shifters have multiple forms. They've got their birth form, the animal form, or human if they're born the animal. Then they've got near human, which for a werewolf is you're big and hairy. You've got near animal, which for a werewolf is like you're a dire wolf. Then you've got war form, which, you know, is a werewolf. Spider
slightly different.
Yes. Spider has human, near human, which is lots of eyes and legs coming out of your back. War form, which is spider, monster, fly, terror.
Yeah.
And then it has giant tarantula doom form and swarm form.
Where you just turn into a little bunch of tiny ones and crawl all over people and in their nose and out their mouth. And
thousands of little spiders. That's just for you, Voodoo Arcade. We love you.
Crawling into all the orifices.
Moving on.
But yes, allow me to finish about my feelings on the World of Darkness. But like I said, all the other ones, you know, they definitely have that creepy. It's already creepy. Mage, on the other hand, from my experience, I've only played a couple of games. It's more like a game of hope where everything is dire now, but you're kind of working towards something better.
Yes, that's an accurate representation.
Yeah, that would be my feeling. Like all the other splats are kind of like, shit's going to get worse. With Mage, everything's already worse, but you're trying to make it better.
Especially in 20th Anniversary Edition, it's hope in a world of darkness, whereas like in the 90s version, you know, everything's going to end, survive the apocalypse, because 90s. 2000 was coming. But Sean.
Yes. Hi.
Tell us about your experiences with the World of Darkness, but not Mage, because I know the horror for you with Mage is figuring out how to cast a spell. I want to hear you talk about the characters you do enjoy in the World of Darkness, which for the viewers is actually technically Chronicles, but it counts. So let's hear about supporting labor.
I mean, so I guess we're talking about one specific character here. Tyler was like, we're going to do a Hunter game. I was like, okay, take me through the conspiracies. And, you know, it's year 2020. I'm a lib, you know. So, yeah, I know, terrible. Talk about World of Darkness, right? He's like, hey, let's go through them. And he's reading me through this. And he's like, there's, what was it called? It's not the labor union. It's
the local 507th or 407th.
Yeah, it's basically called. It's like the Hunter Labor Union. And I was like, that's me. I want that one. He's like, you haven't even heard it. I don't care. I want that one. So, I just developed this whole character around being in a labor union, and his catchphrase is support labor. But I had to get out of that game for whatever reason. So I only played twice and then apparently died, but then came back. Maybe, don't know. And I made a joke that he can't remember his last name because it had been months by the time I was going to play this character again. And I couldn't remember his last name. So it's just like, he's Macintosh. Something. You know what? He can't remember his last name. So when we played Contagion Chronicle, Tyler's like, you can just play Mac then. That'll be great. And you can play Hunter. And it was that Hunters seemed unique in the sense that they could just attempt to murder all of the monster splats, or it was very interesting to try to go, you know what? There are much horrible things in the universe. You're not so bad, and if I can keep you under my thumb to some degree, you know, you won't eat humans, for lack of a better thing. So yeah, that was actually a lot of fun, basically playing Monster Dad with a Hunter in Contagion Chronicle. So that's the depth of my World of Darkness, was Monster Dad.
Yep.
But that made out with a vampire, so that was fun.
Yes you did.
Yeah. Which Slider's like, she makes out with you. I'm like, okay, sure. Like, okay.
I mean, when you reciprocate the flirting, that's what happens.
I mean, you know, yes. You did
on multiple occasions.
Look, it was complicated on his Facebook status, which he still doesn't know how to use. His relationship status is, it's complicated. Like, permanently.
As far as Mage goes, unlike a lot of the other splats where, like, Hunter the Reckoning or Hunter the Vigil, which is what Sean's talking about, where you hunt monsters, the vampires, the werewolves, crazy serial killers with supernatural powers, or Duane playing a were spider and Werewolf the Apocalypse. Those are clearly horror games. As you can tell from our memories, Mage, nebulous. Because in Mage of the Ascension, you're playing somebody who has a spark of awakening where he can manipulate reality, or she or they can manipulate reality at a fundamental level to create change the way they want through how they view the universe, whatever their philosophy is. And the traditional villains were wizard mages versus science mages, and the science mages are like Agent Smith and the Terminator. So it wasn't the same kind of horror feeling. But go ahead, Duane.
I was going to say, but you still had the boogeyman.
Yes. But they created a supervillain to pull the strings of all of the factions called the Nefandi, which are pure irredeemable evil. In the original version of the game in the 90s, they were more twirling mustachioed supervillains. Like, they were all crazy cultist Cthulhu worshippers, or they were straight up infernalists who got power from Satan, or they were wildly insane mages who lost control of their powers and everything just changed around them at their whim. That last one especially was problematic because they had some not so great interpretations of actual mental illness that they have endeavored to clean up in 20th anniversary. But like I always say, in the 90s, it was a bunch of guys that didn't have Google. They did what they could, and it was still real good for its time. So these, when they came around to 20th anniversary edition, they wanted to make it less cartoonish, both for the technocracy, which became much more nuanced, a lot of more context. Are they really the bad guys? You can play them. You could actually play them in older versions, but in this version, you could play them as good guys if you wanted to. So they decided to make the Nefandi the true supervillains. And they wrote Book of the Fallen. There had been two books before that, Book of Madness, and I can't even remember what the older one was called, detailing Infernalism and the Nefandi and whatnot. But they radically changed them in the Book of the Fallen. And that was our main topic today, because we play a lot of mage on our channel. Is how does one deal with the true evil that exists in mage and still maintain consent at your table? Because the Book of the Fallen in M20, very first thing you see after you open the first page is a giant content warning that says, this book deals explicitly with abusive people, activities, and cultures. Not to glorify them, but to expose them. This book features graphic depictions and discussions involving abuse of children and adults, trauma, war, bigotry, blasphemy, torture, human trafficking, sexual violation, and other forms of human malignancy. This is your chance to turn back now. Things only get worse from here. And while we handle such subject matter with maturity and sensitivity, we strongly encourage you to consider your limits before going forward. How I treat the show where we use these as villains. We have the much shorter but similar preface at the beginning. Because in this reinterpretation of the world, Nefandi aren't just cartoon supervillains. They are true evil. And Nefandi's purpose in reality is to bring everything back to oblivion. The ultimate state of existence should be nihilism, should be returned to ultimate zero. The universe has been screaming in pain ever since light first appeared, and noise and chaos has never stopped. But the way the Nefandi envision returning it to zero is because in Mage, what you believe becomes real. So the only way to bring humans to oblivion is to convince the majority of humans, the consensus, that they want to end. There is no point in living. Oblivion is the way to go. How do you convince the majority of 7 billion people that's the way to be? Slowly but surely, strip away all hope from them. What's the best way to strip away all hope? Hurt them until they stop caring and can't feel anything. So the Nefandi are treated as true evil. They are, in order to become one, you have to actually willingly and of your own free will and volition enter what they call a call that takes your magical essence, rips it apart, reconstructs it in its opposite, and shoves it back inside of you. And to get that far, you have to commit all kinds of real gross atrocities. You can't just decide, I'm a bad guy now. You have to prove it by doing worse and worse and worse things. And the main author of the book, Phil Brucato, promised years ago he'd never release a player's guide to the Nefandi. So the first thing we're going to touch on is that as a subject. Let's talk about playing the villain, both the cartoon supervillain version and allowing your players to explore real evil from their own point of view. Let's start with Sean. What are your thoughts on that?
I was thinking about this as you were talking, and just sort of we live in that sort of postmodern, post-capitalism sort of world where any comic book villain or just villains up to this point are basically all hedge fund managers. Like they're not that, they're just greed is their motive and whatever. Like we're almost cynical towards that. Like show me something new. Where when you were first talking about the Nefandi, when we played Technocracy Reloaded like almost a year ago now, like that, we are in that moment of we basically only have hope to get us up in the morning, because I mean we lived for a year where every morning was an existential crisis, and I don't think that really ended, especially with COVID. Like your mortality and your sort of place in the universe, we talked about this in our other episode, like your place in the universe now is very recognizable in how useless you are or how insignificant you are, and hope's kind of the only thing that you have, whether that's hope for a bigger payday or hope for just to eat a really good meal or something like that. It's those basic, very small hopes that I think get people up in the morning, And yeah, when you start shattering that, like, society is just going to start falling and crashing. And because we're all just going to say, you know what, fuck it, I'm just going to go do whatever, because it doesn't matter at this point, because the world is winning the Fandy win. Evil. Exactly. Like that. There is a direct parallel to modern existence to, I don't remember when Mage 20th was written, but I can see if it was written a little while ago, they tapped into something that was not that far off. And I think is
2016.
Yeah. See, okay. So see that, I mean, it didn't take long, and we were in 2016, things were just kind of like starting to get miserable. And
yeah, which means the book was written before Trump.
Right.
Right before. So, right.
Yeah, it's like, you know, like, not to say that life sucks, but life is pain with those small moments of happiness, and you just kind of live for those moments of happiness, and you just have to realize that your existence is futile, and you just got to make the best of what you got. And I realize this is really fatalistic of me to say, but I don't, you know, I wake up, I enjoy a good cheeseburger, and that's my day. That's a triumph. That's a championship. That's a, you know, that's a accomplishment. So I feel like I think villains are moving towards, I like where villains are going now, where villains are true villains, because there was that whole thing where like, oh, I want to be Ursula and Captain Hook and whatever. Like, what the fuck ever? Villains are villains. Villains are evil. Like, you don't want to be the villain. Villains are bad. Like, they come out and ruin your day. I mean, you can be a hedge fund manager and villain, and that's fine. But we need more. We live in a very gray world, and I think it needs to get a little more black and white so that we get our boundaries back and are able to, like, that's bad. You shouldn't be doing that. Like, people need to be called out on their shit and shamed into, you know, doing the right thing. So I think getting some true, very dark evil, I'm just going to ruin all of existence, because I think that's what it should be. Like, it is almost that cosmic horror thing where, like, something like Cthulhu is beyond our recognition, and it just kind of wants to do what it wants to do and doesn't care that you're in its way. And that's a great villain. I think that's the type of villains that I want to write about now.
Also, I lied, 2015. It was written in 2014, published in 2015. But I would like to point out, beyond that small correction,
same thing.
Yeah. I also like how you just described the real world exactly the way the world of darkness works. The villain, the true monsters want to make no one care, but the hope is those little victories. So you just described the entire game setting in real life. Yes.
Yeah, I think that's I think playing a bit of Mage sort of helped refine my life philosophy in more recent times. And not only did playing games online with you guys kind of help get me through, but I think the more you talk with people who have those more high level conversations, you start to sort of figure out life, and you kind of realize, okay, I'm not gonna freak out over the small stuff, because the small stuff doesn't matter. It's just what's gonna get me to a small victory today, and you move forward.
Yeah, that's actually what scares a lot of, not scares, but what puts off a lot of people about Mage is it's so philosophy heavy, but it's also its strength, because like you said, it helps you, like, viewing the world through a philosophical lens in a game helps you do it in real life.
Puts everything into perspective.
Yes. So Dwayne, what about your experiences? I know you said earlier you had both sides of the coin.
Wow.
Playing evil.
Yeah, I don't know if I can follow up Sean's philosophical, you know, explanation of the word evil.
Go ahead and try.
But I for a long time I was a player in most of the RPGs, and occasionally DM'd when I have had characters who wanted to be evil. And I guess it really comes down to no matter what setting you're playing in, as far as a character goes, you really need to understand what, you know, kind of like how Sean said, you need to understand what evil really is in that setting. If you have the setting where the evil guys are comical, and thinking back to, like, you know, 80s and 90s cartoons, it wasn't about destroying worlds and you know mass murder and stuff. It was all about money, robbing banks and stuff like that. It's like, okay, well, really, when you look at, you know, Dungeons and Dragons, half the times your characters really are evil, because you're running around killing stuff, looting places. I mean, In some essence, everybody's got a little bit of evil in them.
That dragon has treasure. Let's take it.
Yeah, let's take it out. Let's take their treasure. I mean, that's, yeah. But then, you know, when you get into games where evil is, you know, going against the law and the goodness of, I don't remember where I read it, but somebody put it very well, like going against, rejecting laws and going against the good gods or being absence of gods, whether those be evil or not, because evil has their own tenets as well, you know, the evil gods. So when you go into that and you're talking about, you know, mass murder and destruction of worlds and stuff like that, as a player, it's very difficult to keep your mind set into not just murder hoboing everything. I mean, because not only does it make it boring for everyone else, you know, just running around and, you know, killing all of the townsfolk, you need to take a step back and really think, okay, well, if I am going to play an evil person in this setting, you just don't want to throw yourself out there and have the GM throw all the good guys at you. You know, you don't want to run through town and killing a bunch of people. You're like, hey, I'm the evil guy, come kill me. So you really need to think methodically and play your character almost as a good character, but with bad tendencies, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, I get that. That's, yeah, because, like, even unless you're, like, an Afandi, most evil gods or characters don't necessarily want to annihilate all of existence because they have a reason to exist in the world that they're in. Like, the god of death needs people to be born so that they can die. Like, if they kill everybody and there's nothing but death, then death doesn't have a reason for existence. So, like, if everything is death, then what's the point? Like, you need more power.
It's a definite balance.
Yeah.
That segues into my opinion on the subject very nicely. In order to play evil, you can't, like Dwayne said, you can't play evil. Supervillains in comic books are one thing, but real villains are not Carnage from Venom. Real villains are Thanos. They Yes. don't think they're villains. They think what they're doing is necessary, and they have deep-seated reasons for it, and they believe it. Mm. They think you're the villain, or at Yes. least in the way.
Yeah.
So, knowing that...
I saw a review of, what was it, Infinity War. Thanos is the protagonist of that movie. He is the protagonist, and the Avengers and everybody are the antagonists of that movie. That's how that movie should be watched. Yes. I mean, the second one fucking killed Thanos, but the first one, Thanos is your hero, for lack of a better term, because he's the one with the quest, the journey, and everybody, and everybody's just trying to stop him. So, I think Dwayne just said it, like, you have, or maybe you said it, you have to play your villain has to be his own hero,
have your occasional evil, but what everyone else would consider evil tendencies.
Yeah, but I'm also not a fan of, like, redeemable heroes or, like, humanized I don't like humanized villains. Like, the villain needs to be a bad guy. Like, there should be no gray areas.
That's why I have a problem with it, because if you play a villain correctly, you accept that you see the world your way because you're the good guy of your own story.
Yes.
So I'm actually going to read the first page again of the Book of Madness, or the Book of the Fallen. He starts with a quote from Juliet by the Marquis de Sade. "The world must tremble upon learning of the crimes we've committed. Men must be made to blush and feel ashamed as belonging to the same species as we do. I demand that a monument be raised to commemorate this crime and signal to the whole world, and that our name should be graven upon it by our own hands." And he says, "I promised long ago I would never release a player's guide to Nefandi. This isn't one. Here's why. One of my earliest memories involves my fascination with a pretty tile on our kitchen counter. When I asked my mother what it was for, she did something I couldn't see, took me by the hand, lifted me up, and held my hand to the plate. It was a ceramic hot plate. I was 3 or 4 years old. When I screamed and pulled my hand away from her, Mom said with chilling calm, 'Now you know why you should never, ever touch that plate.' I love my mom, but that was a fucked up thing to do to a toddler." She meant well, I guess. And she says she doesn't remember it now. I do, though. I can't forget it. About 5 years later, my family lived next door to a family called the Dunlaps. My sister and I were good friends with their kids. Some evenings, though, we would sit at the dinner table and listen to screams and smashing sounds coming through our townhouse wall. A few times, my father went over to have a word with Mr. Dunlap. Most nights, we would sit around the table and pretend not to hear the guy beating the shit out of his wife and kids. Like I said, their daughter and I were friends. One day, we were messing around with a tape recorder, and she made some jokes that, in hindsight, strongly implied that her father was molesting her as well as beating her. Such a thought was totally alien to me when I was 8. I no longer have those tapes, and I'm really glad I can't hear them with my middle-aged ears. Memories are bad enough. And then he says stuff for 2 more pages that we won't talk about on the podcast, because that guy had a messed up life at times. And at the end, he says, evil is not a toy. It's the kid up your block who dresses like a ninja and brags about how he plans to break into girls' rooms and attack them and then cut their throats. It's the boyfriend of your sister who says he'll assault your girlfriend just for fun, then holds you down and beat your ass just to show you that you can't stop him from doing it. This isn't four color evil, and if you're looking for a little comfort food sadism, then put this book down and go elsewhere. Evil can be sexy. It can be cool. It's often powerful, because any and every tactic to evil is fair game. But it doesn't look like bug-eyed monsters. It looks like us. It lives in a mother's good intentions and a father's drunken force. And then it walks down the streets alongside us. And only when it jumps out at us do we even know it's there. That's why I wrote this book. That's where this comes from. That's why there's not a character sheet at the end of this book. I can't stop you from playing a fallen mage if you choose. But I'm not going to encourage you to do so. The book is not a player's guide for fictional monstrosities. It's a warning about real monsters who are already here. From the point of view of a GM, more than a player, I do our horror games, obviously. But for the audience, I'm the main horror guy. Dwayne's close second. But I do the Sunday show, which is the real horror show, the one that Sean won't even play in because of some of the themes we touch on. And
now you just won't let me punch him.
It's starting to come out in the show, but the people in that show who played with me offline have seen this. We're slowly working up to full Tyler on the show, but I will go all in on the villains. And in order to role play those characters, I have to be them for 3 hours or 4 hours. So like the recent session where I had Lacey, the evil Nefandi, slowly torture and murder a barista at a coffee shop because she was bored in lurid detail, I had to sit down, imagine that, write it out, and then describe it like I was enjoying it. There's a price for that. If you don't, like, everybody has a method. Some people even ritualize it. Like, I have to do a little meditative and physical cleanse after shows like that. I have to throw up some meditative sounds on YouTube and play them while I'm in the shower washing myself, because if not, I'll go to bed and have some real messed up dreams. I think it's dangerous to play villains in games, because if you put yourself in the mindset of someone from their point of view that they're not evil, it changes you. That's my personal opinion.
I remember when I first started getting in gaming, you know, you do like 4 or 5 heroic games, and then everybody's like, let's play a villain game, let's play a monster game. It's like, okay, whatever. And it lasts for like 2 sessions, basically because nobody really knows how to play evil, or everybody realizes that, oh, playing evil is not that comfortable. Like it either ends up in a murder betrayal fest, or everybody just goes, you know what? Not as fun. Not as fun. Not great. Not fun.
I think one of the things I was talking to before the show with Dwayne was, there's also the whole, that could break up friendships. It's the monopoly of TTRPGs.
Yeah.
Go ahead, Dwayne.
I was going to say, as a GM, I agree with you, Tyler. I don't want my players to play evil characters or the bad guys, if you will. But what I think is, when most players are like, yeah, let's do something, you know, we want to play as evil. It's not that they want to be the bad guys. They want to be like, you know, you have the hero, then you have the anti-hero, and then you have the evil hero.
Yeah, they want to be the Punisher.
Yeah and just, even the Punisher is like the anti-hero. Now, you can still be an evil hero. That's like the one that comes in where, you know, you can be part of the party.
That's Venom in the early days.
And yeah, everyone has a moral qualm with, oh no, what are we going to do? And you just come in and say, well, I got this, whap, and have no problem with it. But some people can't do that. All they want to do is just, oh, I want to be evil. I'm just going to run around and set fires and burn things. It's, it becomes comical, and then it loses its meaning.
Yeah.
Yeah. When there's a lot of evil in the room, evil is comical. I think you're right. Like evil needs to be a singular focus thing that is sort of the event to triumph over, not everybody just running around stealing from the church ladies and things like that, like, or that's killing exactly the town guards or whatever. Yeah, like
that's exactly it. The Connery from our friends over at Devil's Luck Gaming put on Twitter the other day, like, he summarized it for me perfectly. As a storyteller, I play pretty messed up characters in TTRPGs, safety tools in place. At times, I play some of the most antithetical beings to my very existence, but it's worth it for the players to have the catharsis of hitting these demons in a safe place. Still squicks me, though.
Oh, man.
That about sums it up for me. Like, they should be there so the players can explore dealing with that sort of thing, sometimes even facing fears, and then getting to kick it in the balls real hard.
Mm. Yeah, I feel something like Disney made villains glamorous.
They really did.
They did, and it's like, like, I get it. He dresses well, and he sings some really cool songs, and got that baritone voice, and man, she's a glam queen. But look, no, just no. All you kids who like wanted to dress up like Ursula, you know, she did some really fucked up things, and let's not overlook that. Like,
well, like I said earlier,
a lot of lives.
You know, like I said earlier,
it's kids,
you know,
dogs.
Back then, being evil was comical. You know, it's running and right. You know, tying the girl on the train track and then standing there twisting your mustache going, ha 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 ha. You know, that's not evil nowadays.
Yeah. I think we live in a bigger, more intelligent, more informative world, and you realize just there is no real innocence left. You realize just how fucked up the world is, and that, oh, you know, even that sort of cartoonish villainy, there's many layers now of like sexism and like abuse, and just in tying a woman to a train track, that we know so much more now that, oh yeah, that's not great. There's a lot of layers there going back.
Being evil is like being an onion.
The many layers of evil. Layers. In every layer will make you cry.
There you go.
The more you peel off, it's like, oh shit, no, God, kill me now.
So, following up on the Dungeon Master side of things, back to Dwayne. How do you handle it when, I know a lot of your stuff is Strange Aeons, but when it's not Strange Aeons, like when it's Black Boyd and whatnot, tell the people listening how you handle making it a safe space to explore concepts like that for your players.
So, especially nowadays, where gaming isn't in person and you're doing a lot of this online, and especially with people that you don't know, obviously the biggest thing that you want is consent. Like, you want to understand what everyone is comfortable with, situations. Boundaries. I'm sorry?
Boundaries.
Yes. Boundaries. Even simple words that may seem inconsequential to you or someone else, but may not be to someone else in the party. When we run our games for all of Vorpal Tales, we always do a consent sheet at the beginning of the campaign or whatever setting that we're doing, which outlines, you know, the concept of the game, the tone, the rating of the game, whether it be, you know, PG-13, R, NA, or not NA, was it MA?
Sure. Yeah, MA.
Not applicable.
Yeah.
All those non-applicable games we play.
And then it goes through different types of horror, like, are you okay with bugs? Are you okay with snakes? Harm to animals, things like that. Relationships, any type of different romance relationships, any different types of sex. All of this stuff is required by us for our players And they need to go through and say whether they're okay with it totally, whether they would like to know when it's coming so you can maybe fade to black or give it a limited amount of scene, or if it's just a completely red, like, we don't want this topic at all. And then once you have gathered all of those consent forms, you as the GM need to go through and say, all right, well, I was planning for this. This individual is not okay with this. So you have to change your story. You have to make your players feel comfortable in their setting. It's not for you to sit there and say, well, this is my world and this is how it's going to be, and you're just here to play in it. No, you are creating a world for them to be comfortable in, no matter where they are. And a couple of things that you need to remember as a GM when, you know, finding out the consent, you need to realize that the ultimate, you know, with any consent that's going around nowadays, the automatic answer is no. If someone didn't say anything about it, then it's going to be a no.
You have to assume no. Yeah.
Yeah. You have to assume no.
Mm-hmm. I think that goes back to that whole concept of, like, some GMs think the relationship between player and GM is adversarial when it's not. Yeah. You're a facilitator. There's a social contract between you and the players to tell a story that they enjoy. You're not there to mess up their heads and mess with their lives.
Right. Yeah. People in horror games enjoy being freaked out. They're not there so that you can make them cry. Although, I mean, sometimes that's enjoyable too. It's a safe way. People don't necessarily always think of this, but some people use role-playing to explore real-life trauma or even real-life phobias and fears in a safe environment. So you might have your players sobbing on camera, but they're like, I'm fine. Keep going. This is good for me. This is cathartic. I haven't seen it much, but I've seen it. And for that, we have consent cards.
Yes, which was what I was just about to talk about, but go ahead.
No, you go.
Oh, yeah. So when you are playing your game, no matter what consent anyone has given about a specific situation, at any time during our games, we have Discord running, but you can, at any time, you can hold up what do we have? The O's, the X's for no's.
The O is for checking in. Are you okay? That's usually the dungeon master asking a player. And then we have yes and no replies from the players, and they have a stop card to just, if they ever put up the stop card, just stop and go on break until you figure out what's wrong.
Go on break and make sure that you're checking up with your players. If you do have this type of situation, you know, you want to do that after care. They say that they're not okay with the situation and you need to go on to break. Don't just say, okay, well, we're going on a 10, 15 minute break. And then don't be like, hey, you know, are you all right? Just, you know, don't just automatically go to the bathroom and say, well, we'll come back to this later. You know, these are your players. These are most likely your friends, or, you know, hopefully it's something that's not happening in the very first session. Because if it's happening in the very first session, then you really need to rethink your entire campaign.
Don't murder the player's cat when right out the gate, you know.
Right.
The better the role player too, the more often you should check in, like at our Cyberpunk Red game.
Yes.
Michelle is a good role player, but sometimes you need to check in because there's also bleed over where what's happening to your character affects you as a person for some people, and you got to make sure the tears are fake. Or like Dixie Cyanide is really, really good at adversarial arguing, and sometimes I feel like I should check in on the people on the opposite end of the argument going, you do know this is still just role playing, right? And you're not actually being yelled at. These are all real things in role playing.
Yeah. And, you know, you have to understand that all of these topics that you're talking about in your consent form, that everything's on a spectrum. You know, while somebody may say on their consent form that they're okay with it, if you tweak one word or add one adjective to whatever statement you thought was okay, someone might have a problem with it. It's just that one thing that'll throw them off. So you have to be very open-minded. And, you know, if someone has a problem with it, you know, you don't go back to your consent form and be like, no, you said you were all right with this. You, as a GM, you don't need a reason why they're not okay with it. You just say, okay, make sure that they're all right, and you move on. It's not trying to, like, sell them a poop sandwich. No matter how delicious you feel that this poop sandwich is, they're not going to take the poop sandwich.
Also, you got to build up a thick skin because it's not personal and you might think it is sometimes. You don't like my story? No, they just don't like that you're trying to rape their robot without their consent. It's not hard.
I'm not even going to touch on that one.
Yeah, like it's rarely personal for the GM when a player needs to tap out. If ever. It's never been personal for me.
No, not for me. I mean, I honestly haven't had a situation where anyone has tapped out. So I don't know how I would feel, but well, actually I do know how I feel. I wouldn't feel bad at all. I mean, like I said before, this is a space where you're trying to make them feel comfortable and it's supposed to be fun. And obviously if they're uncomfortable, they're not having fun. So
exactly. And even Sean uses consent, even though he plays the most or runs usually the most lighthearted of our stories. Cause, you know, you never know, like his most recent adventure, it's an 80s game. So it has a silly 80s trope for the name. But he had to make sure before he used that name that no one was going to be offended by the word porn just in the title of the game. Because like Dwayne said, even a simple word that doesn't bother you
can bother somebody else.
Yeah, I mean, yes, I do play a lighter hearted game, but I've come to know that if I do play a very, I'm fucking mean. Like I'm kind of relentless. So like, and it comes out sometimes, like I will hammer your character until you're fucking dead. Yeah, like I try to limit that just because sometimes I just don't have an off switch, and I know that it's I think it's more effective to run sort of a lighthearted game and be able to just go, all right, you're fucking dead now because you made a stupid mistake, or because this guy's really fucking powerful and sorry, you know, or yeah, he killed your dog because that's what he is, and just like, you know, you're able to pull it out of nowhere. I think that's I find it's an effective tool for me to just turn it on every once in a while and then just be like, okay, yeah, they're just bullies now.
Yeah, that's the same for me. Is that's an on switch on Sundays most of the time, but you got to know when to turn it off, and sometimes that's a fine line. Yeah,
yeah,
like if I say we're doing cult next week, they all assume everyone's gonna die.
Right, right. Given. I have no qualms with that at all.
I just try to make it an enjoyable party wipe.
I try to keep some of the surprise in my games just in like trust the dice. But when those dice are hitting hard, like you don't let up, and you run with, if the dice are saying, hey, yeah, that person's pretty much fucking dead, then that person's pretty much fucking dead. So.
And because we have tools in place for to warn us when it's too far, you don't have to worry
right
as much.
It's like, okay, I'm done. You're cool. You're too much. We're done. Sorry, Dwayne. You were going to say something.
Oh, no. I was just going to say for anyone who's listening that is starting to run their own games and doesn't exactly know what we're talking about when we talk about consent in gaming, especially in RPGs, I highly suggest you get a copy of Consent in Gaming by Sean K. Reynolds and Shauna Germain.
Yes.
It pretty much highlights everything that you need to know as a storyteller, GM, whatever you want to call it, and how to implement those in your game. And it even comes with checklists so that you can either make your own or use theirs. But I highly recommend that you have that on hand as your first thing that you're going to read before you even go into reading a pre-made module or anything like that.
Yeah. And if you watch our show, our modern consent forms are actually Google Forms based now, but we still have our old PDF ones. Just pop into our Discord and be like, hey, can I get a copy? You can have it. You can copy it. We copied it from other people who let us do it. Yeah. No one cares if you copy other people's format, if it means if you're encouraging more self-care for your players.
Yeah. And I know I said it before and I'm going to say it again, because I think this is one of the things I've learned most recently, or one of the sort of styles that I've learned. Gaming is a conversation between you and the players. Like, you are not there to hurt them. You're there to give them a good time. Now, that good time may be, you know, destroying their psyches, which that's part of consent, but like, you're there to tell a good story and then to basically make an entertaining 4 hours or whatever it is. You're not there. Like, the point of you are playing the villains and you are being the bad guys in the game, but like, you are not the bad guy and they're not the good guys. And it's not a protagonist antagonist thing. Like, it's a conversation. You're making a story. You're making an enjoyable piece of entertainment for 4 hours or however long. Like, it's like, work with you, have a conversation, work with your players. Like, you should all be friends, hopefully, or at least by the end of the first session, you can consider some of them them friends and just have a conversation and work things out and talk. It's okay to stop and go, you know what? We're out of game mode right now. Let's talk. Let's try to figure things out.
Yeah. And you should be encouraging an environment that's the exact opposite of what everyone's parents thought RPGs were in the 80s, where you're all going to end up putting on cultist robes, worshiping Satan and sacrificing virgins or something, like the satanic panic everyone thought D&D was in the 80s. We've essentially created the exact opposite of what our parents were scared of. We've created a safe environment to explore things in the real world that are terrifying and we have no protection from in real life.
We only do it for a couple hours now.
Yeah, nothing dressing up in cult robes and sacrificing a good version is, you know, not fun, but it can't be all that.
It's like the old White Wolf books used to say, all the old White Wolf books at the beginning and the end used to have a little disclaimer that said, this is a role-playing game. And if you can't separate that, it's time to stop. Put the book down, go take a walk. Yeah. There has to be boundaries.
I do like something that Tyler said earlier about how a lot of people, I shouldn't say a lot of people, but some people use games, RPG games nowadays, to deal with something that they may have experienced in the past. And they want to use this fantasy type setting to kind of like, you know, work through it. Or if it's some kind of fear, you know, give them a little bit of, you know, facing their fears. So, you know, help them along the way of doing that. Make it an easy transition, if you will.
Yes. If you made their lives better, you've done the ultimate success level of storyteller.
Yeah,
absolutely.
You kind of want everybody cheering and going, that was fun by the end of everything. Like that's what you want to hear.
I agree.
I do. Yeah.
And I think that's a good scary tale ending to this episode. And on a positive note for once with the horror show, Sean,
mm-hmm.
You won't feel gross this week.
Oh, you're not going to do puns?
Well, I'm still going to do puns. We thank you, audience, for listening to us and creeping it real. Like that one.
No.
We will return next week we'll be discussing a new fun topic in terror, Sean's least favorite role-playing game, Cult Divinity Lost, and associated topics and themes of said game.
Yeah, can we just style that one where I have a set of questions and just ask you and just be like, what the fuck is this?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, we can.
Keep in mind, when we do that one, there will probably be a disclaimer at the beginning.
Yes, sir, and maybe in the middle.
Yeah, because that one, like we said today, you know, consent. We will be talking about some pretty interesting topics on that one. So make sure you're ready to listen.
Arguably, meaning not necessarily absolutely, but arguably the most adult horror role-playing game, yes.
Yeah,
but
they read me the description or like the opening thing to that. I was like, no, dog, I'm out. I'm good. Thanks.
We are, however, also going to discuss how awesome the rule set is. And Sean will be happy to talk about games where the GM doesn't have to roll dice ever.
Yeah.
But until then, good audience, stay scary, but don't be jerk-o'-lanterns. Goodbye.
Bye.
Thank you.